Welcome to the More We Know podcast with your host and social media influencer, Mir. Gen Zs and millennials need information now. That is why Mir is bringing in experts from all around the world. Because the more we know, the more we learn, and the more we earn. Here is your host now. Enjoy.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome back to the More We Know podcast. My name is Mir, your host. The More We Know podcast is the world's mentorship platform. The More We Know aims to provide you real life mentorship in your pocket, wherever you're at, whether you're on the way to work, whether you're at school, whether you're at home, whether you're at the gym, like our friend Demola here, you are listening to a mentor in your pocket. The reason we launched The More We Know is because a lot of people, frankly, don't have access to mentors, and we want to give back by giving you a mentor in your pocket. So we brought on people like the former CEO of Chipotle, the founder of Reebok, the mayor of Miami. And I know I tell you guys this, but this one I wasn't only excited for, but I'm nervous for because of the caliber of the person we brought on to meet with these other people. And it is Demola Adamolukin, who is the current CEO of P.F. Chang's. I don't even have to give a background on P.F. Chang's. You probably have it in the city near you. They have over 200 restaurants now. He is not only the CEO, but he's leading their strategic initiatives, ensuring their continued growth and success. They're one of the largest upscale dining Asian restaurant brands in the world. And Demola, alongside doing this, would you believe it, is also a managing partner at Paulson & Co., the hedge fund that purchased the chain for $700 million in 2019. There is a ton of background here. You probably might have seen him. There was a recent TikTok that went viral of him for his 4 a.m. runs. We're going to get into all of that, but we have the CEO of P.F. Chang's here, a brand that was quite frankly struggling a few years back during COVID and has since changed. So we're going to learn all the secrets about that. Demola, thank you for being our mentor today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the introduction.
Well, thank you, Demola. Let's kick it right off then. Obviously, you know, most people know who P.F. Chang's is, the restaurant. Most people probably dined at P.F. Chang's. I don't know if a lot of people know that you're the CEO. I think when you became CEO, you actually made some history. Before getting into that, you know, talk about who is Demola. Like, who were you growing up? What did your parents do? Like, remind us back to your childhood, please.
It's a story that traverses a lot of different places. But I was born in Nigeria, in a town called Ile Ife, which is a small town in Southwest Nigeria. My dad's a doctor. He's a neurologist, and my mother's a pharmacist. And so I was raised, you know, by a very well-educated family and one that placed a lot of priority on education. I weren't very well off financially, but there's a ethos within my family that you could achieve anything via education and that, you know, the standards are pretty high, right? Very, very high achieving family kind of overall. I moved to a few different places. I lived in Amsterdam for a few years. I lived in Zimbabwe for 2 years, and then moved to the States when I was 9. And I lived in Illinois, and I lived in Maryland before I went to college at Brown in Providence. And, you know, so moving around a lot growing up, I'd say one thing that became kind of a staple in my life was sports and athletics, right? I was an athletic kid, and as a young boy being new in a lot of different places, the easiest way to make friends is sports, right? So I was always, me and my brothers were always playing whatever sport people played. You know, we were in Illinois, it was basketball. When I was in Maryland, it was football. And so I became an athlete, and I played football at Brown when I went there for college, and ultimately transitioned to a career in finance and investing at Goldman Sachs in my first job post-college. So kind of long story all over the place, but I'd say, you know, my family is one of, you know, my dad moved us here to create more opportunities for us. It was his decision to move from Nigeria and have these different stops and then ultimately come to the States. And, you know, we've been lucky to be able to kind of make that decision worthwhile.
I love that. And, you know, it's some of my best friends are Nigerian, and, you know, the culture in the Middle East and Nigeria in general is very similar. I think I can just, you know, my parents are doctors, so I can already imagine sort of the household you grew up in. But it's this level of standard that we're held to with hard work. And, you know, we candidly don't really know what hard work is till we see what our parents did when they come from the countries they came from,
Absolutely.
Becoming medical doctors. My dad became a doctor here, and, you know, it's the same sort of process. So I'm not surprised with the path you've taken. But, Good. You know, What about your parents? Were they pushing you to get into finance? Did they want you to go into medicine, or were they very open and say, hey, Demola, this is, you know, you do whatever you want?
My parents expected me and my siblings to excel. And you'll relate to this, but, you know, I grew up in this sort of household where if I came back with a report card and I had, you know, six A's and one B, the question was, what's going on with that B, right? There was an expectation that I could be as good as anybody, and there was no excuse not to be, right? So, okay, my dad would say, what's going on with that B? Is the subject matter too hard? I'm like, no, I can do it. Okay, is there a problem with the teacher? So what's the issue, right? That was always the mentality is, why aren't you getting an A? That's what you should be getting. So, but it was never about, you know, my dad's not a business person. He's an academic. My mom's business savvy, but she's a pharmacist. So it was never like do any particular thing. Their point of view was whatever you do, just be the best, right? I remember when I first moved to America, and I would have been like 9 or 10 years old, but we went to get our hair cut at the barbershop in Springfield in Illinois. And the barber was rolling around in an S-Class Benz, right? Because it was the best barber in the city and everybody went there. And my dad stopped and said, you know, look, in America, even if you're a barber, it doesn't matter what you do. If you're the best at whatever it is you can do really well. You can buy a Benz. You can live a great life, right? So the idea was just do what you're interested in, but be the best at it no matter what it is, right? Like that was kind of the attitude that my family had. And so, you know, I developed an interest in finance and investing. It's different than what my parents do, but they always supported it and always, you know, appreciated the accomplishments. As long as you're trying your best and you're working hard and you're trying to excel, they were generally pretty happy.
I love that. And I think, you know, I love what your dad said, coming here to the land of opportunity, being able to, you know, excel at something and be paid appropriately for it. Now, I'm trying to put the timeline together because, correct me if I'm wrong, are you 33 or 34 now?
I'm 34 now.
Okay. It's a shock to hear how young you are. So I know the audience listening is like, wait, what the heck? P.F. Chang's 34. But if I'm putting the timeline together, you know, when you were 23, 24, getting into that Goldman side, you know, we were coming off not too long from a 2008 crash. As you know, medicine is a much more technically stable career than finance because, you know, finance, you have a couple of these one-off events and all of a sudden banks go under, whatever happens. What was the passion from finance? I just want the audience to sort of like visualize it. Was it just what it really intrigued you about getting to that space?
Well, I decided I wanted to be an investor really in high school. So I've been buying stocks since I was 15 or 16. And that would, you know, when I was still in Maryland. So that would have been 2005, 2006. And for me, you know, I had kind of, you know, service jobs in high school. My first job was at a KFC. My dad still has my first pay stub. I made like $50 in like 2 weeks. And that was when I was, you know, I can't remember, 15, I think. And I worked as a waiter during high school. But I, you know, in school, I was a football player, but I also had an English teacher that had me join the speech and debate team. She like insisted. It was one of these very persuasive teachers that's like, you know, you should really do this. And so I joined speech and debate. I ended up being the state champion for debate as a junior. And I gave a speech at this competition, this four-way rotary speech contest. And I won. And I won $10,000 for a scholarship. But they gave it to me as a check, right? So it's for school, but they just gave me the money. And it was way more money than I'd ever had at any point, you know, to that point. But I decided I wanted to invest the money, right? And so I started trying to figure out what I could do with it, right? I remember I didn't know how much $10,000 was. I thought I could buy a house. I was like, let me buy a property. Let me fix it up. I'll sell it. You know, this is the real estate boom in 05, 06, and everybody's buying real estate. And that's all you see on anywhere you look. Quickly realized it wasn't enough money to do any of that. But I could buy stocks, right? So I started reading about stock investing. There's a website, I'm sure it's still there, called The Motley Fool that I used. I read a lot about Warren Buffett back then. And so I'd go to the gym and there'd be like business people there. I'd talk to them, ask them questions, pick their brains. So I set up a stock portfolio on like E-Trade and started buying stocks. And, you know, it's 05, the market's going up. I'm making money. I'm like, you know, starting to think I'm really good at this. When anybody could buy any stock at that time and make money. But that's when my interest in investing came, is I just started doing it. Right. And by the time I got to college, I was of the mind that I wanted to be an investor. I didn't really know exactly what that meant. I didn't know about investment banking. I'd learn all that, but I kind of directionally knew what I wanted to do, like business and finance and investing. So, you know, I joined the Brown Investment Club. I got involved. I started interning at Goldman when I was a sophomore. So I, very early on, I took that path. Now, the market crashed in 08, like you said, and I was in college at the time. So all my investments that I thought were so fantastic all kind of cratered. And it was a good lesson, actually, because it was the very beginning of my career. So you get to see a downturn, and it makes you a much better investor going through something like that, right? So by the time I came out of college, I'd gone through that. I started working at Goldman and then started pursuing that path on Wall Street.
Now, did the 08 crash, it's obviously it didn't deter you in any way. Was it because a lot of us went through COVID, you know, my audience, all of us are Gen Z. So our first professional crisis was COVID-19.
Sure.
So I'm curious from your perspective, that professional crisis you had, it didn't deter you in any capacity?
Well, I was lucky I was in college, you know, so I didn't get fired. I think if I just started work and let's say I got laid off from Goldman because they cut a bunch of jobs, that, you know, that might have been different. I was protected in a sense because I was a student.
Correct.
I had an internship. A lot of my friends' internships did get canceled, but mine didn't. So I got to be on Wall Street at Goldman in 2008, that summer, right? I was there watching people kind of freak out and go through it. But for me, it was like, I just felt like I was learning a ton, right? Because they didn't have time to babysit. Everybody was, you know, it was like survival mode, right? So if you're there, I don't care if you're 19, 20, whatever, like you're going to be doing something and they're going to need. So it was almost like getting thrown into the deep end and just you learn faster in crises, right? Like there's no time for nonsense. There's no time for babysitting. It's like figure it out, like sink or swim. So I don't know. It's something, you know, I'm an athlete, but there's something about that competition in that moment and the adrenaline. And it's like, we don't know how it's going to go. Is the world ending? Is it not? But here's what we're going to do. And here's the plan. And you start executing and you just get into, so it didn't deter me at all. I thought it was, I don't want to say exciting because, you know, it harmed a lot of people, but as a professional in that, I mean, to be on Wall Street in the middle of a situation like that and have the front row seat and to be learning, I thought it was, you know, it was very helpful for my career to start that way. Right. By the time I got there full time, everything seemed easy because I just went through, I did my first summer in the middle of the recession. I'm like, things are great. So no, there's no hiccup that's going to freak you out once you've started that way. Every little hiccup seems small in comparison. Right. So, you know, it's, and COVID is similar, right? Like, you know, COVID was, I mean, what's going to seem hard once you've managed a business through COVID? Right? You've gone through the worst, right? Now every problem by comparison is going to seem manageable, right? So you learn through hard things, you learn through hard moments, right? And you have to take them on and they're going to happen regardless. So it's just your attitude towards it. But if you approach it with the right attitude and say, I'm going to learn and get better, you're only going to benefit from it.
Yeah. And it's interesting to your point, because I'm very passionate about investing as well.
Yeah.
You kind of realize whether you're a CEO or an investor or an executive in any capacity, whatever you do, there's always something going on. If it's not COVID, it's inflation. If it's not inflation, there's something. If it's a war. So there's so many things going on. And to your point, these situations to make us stronger. So you get to Goldman and, you know, describe your time as because we have listeners that are investment bankers too. Describe your time at Goldman. And then when did you realize it was time to transition out of Goldman?
So I did two summers at Goldman before I started. So by the time I joined, I had a pretty good understanding of what to expect, right? Like banking is hard. It's a lot of hours. It's a lot of, you know, grunt work. You are the most junior person at the firm. There's high expectations, especially at Goldman, that, you know, no mistakes. Like it's supposed to be perfect. Like you'll make mistakes, but it's not, it's expected that you make very few. And when you make one, you learn from it, right? It's very exacting in terms of the standards. But I knew all that when I came in. So for me, it was just time to work. You know, I just put in a lot of hours and put in the time to get good. Now, the other thing is I got staffed on like a major deal, like right off the bat. In my first month, I was working on, you know, Walgreens bought Alliance Boots for like $28 billion in 2012. And I worked on that deal. And it was like my first deal.
Wow.
And so I'm sitting there with the CEO of Walgreens, the CEO of Alliance Boots. I was working on a Kraft Heinz deal. So I was in like some pretty big transactions, like right off the bat. Again, sink or swim, right? Like figure it out, right? So so I was putting a lot of time, but I thought it was fun. Again, I thought it was exciting. Like, you know, you dream of being on Wall Street and you're working at Goldman Sachs, working on a $30 billion merger. Like who gets that sort of experience, right? So it's all attitude with these things, right? When you're young, what else are you going to do but work, right? Like you'll have fun, you'll have your social life, et cetera, but you're young and you have time, like this is what you should be doing. And it'll make you so much better down the line, right? So my advice to young people, I mean, no entry-level job is going to be like glamorous, right? You're going to be working hard. The company might be glamorous and some other things, but it's about hard work when you start, and it's about learning and getting better. And you know how you get better? You take on hard projects and you conquer them, and then you level up, right? It's like a video game. The harder the project, the more you're going to learn and the more you're going to level up. So as a young person, take it on. You know, I said, give me that deal. Give me this deal. I want to work on that deal. You know, I was taking everything. And that's the right attitude when you start.
Yeah. And I think the problem we run into now, it's a little bit different than a decade ago, is now with like social media, Instagram specifically and TikTok, I have so many listeners that we see, and you know, I struggle with it too. You almost like on social media, you see the makeup, right? Obviously no one's going to post the bad parts of their life. Yeah. They want to post the good parts. And like, now it's, you see these 20-year-olds or 22-year-olds that might have made X amount of dollars in Dogecoin or Bitcoin. Yeah. Or they're living these like fake lives on jets all the time. And it sort of deters us from these entry-level jobs. Any advice for people in that capacity thinking, you know, comparing their lives?
Well, most of them are lying, first of all. Yeah. So, I mean, don't compare yourself to a lie, because that's not fair to you.
Absolutely.
Most of them are lying. I mean, there's going to be some people that have made a ton of money on buying the right coin at the right time, et cetera. But those are few and far between. Most people are pretending. And you have to recognize that it's filters and makeup and stories, right?
Yes.
But I understand it's, you know, it's hard to understand when you see it, and that seems to be all you see. Instagram is very bad for your psychology in general. Really, you shouldn't be on it unless you're doing business. There's no real benefit to being on it unless you're doing business and keeping up with your friends. But you can do that in other ways. Mm. It is, I think, a big contributor to depression and negative thought and negative self opinion for young people. I don't have an Instagram, and I did when I was younger, but I got rid of it. It's hard to do because I know social media is a big part of people's lives, especially young people. But if you can get rid of it. Like it doesn't do much positive for you. And you start to compare yourself to lies, and you start to think you're inadequate or you're not doing well enough, and this kid's doing that and that. First of all, most of them are making it up. And even if they aren't, it's not natural to be sitting there viewing all the most successful people in the world and thinking that you're falling short. You know, that's just, it's a difficult dynamic to you know, manage mentally, right? So if you're going to be on it, just recognize it for what it is, and don't be too absorbed in it. And if you can, just get rid of it, right? Like, yeah. I think you'll be better off psychologically.
Yeah, I love the rationale there, which is just, you know, so many people think like, how do I get better at Instagram? How do I get more? But it's like, sometimes the answer is getting rid of it, getting away from it. It's so toxic.
It's not natural. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. So the humans are, you got to understand that there's human biology, right? We're just wired a certain way. And that's been true for thousands of years. Humans are meant to like have like a group of people that you know, and it's your friends and your family and your tribe, quote unquote, mm-hmm. right? To be on a platform with millions of people and trying to keep up with thousands of people, you know, your thousands of followers, is unnatural, and it's going to stress you out. It's going to stress your mind because it's not meant to operate that way. And so if people use it, but you have to be careful or else you'll get lost in it. You'll start trying to look successful versus become successful. You know what the difference is? Trying to look successful is putting the right photos and the right captions and pretending. The only way to actually become successful is to put in hard work. That's the only way, right? It's like sports. You know, the way you get better is you practice. You know, the way you build endurance is you go run hills. The way you become a better receiver is you run 100 routes, right? And that's the way you get better, but that's not glamorous, of course. Now you can pretend, that's only going to get you so far. And then you're going to get to a point where you just don't have what it takes because you never developed it, right? Because you were pretending the whole time. So work on really being better. You can be better. Anything can be improved. You don't like how you speak, you can improve that. You don't like how you think, you can improve that. You don't like whatever. You can get better in all these different categories, just like a video game, but you got to put in the work. That's the only way, right?
Yeah, 100%.
And even the kids that make money off Bitcoin, I almost feel bad for them in a way because they never developed life skills.
Yes.
Right? So maybe they made some money, but they don't have any character. They haven't developed the work ethic. They don't know how to deal with adversity. Because they haven't done it. They, you know, they bought some coin and made a bunch of money, and they're going to be, they might be weak mentally and from a character standpoint forever because they never need to develop it, right? So you should look at it as a blessing. You get to work hard and become a better person. You get to become that guy, or that girl, right? Like, you get to do that. So embrace it.
Yeah, and I can tell your no-nonsense approach to hard work and discipline, you're not just saying it, because look at what it's taken you to in your career. And, you know, so I think the audience, that's a valuable lesson that I hope they rewind.
Well, nothing phases you once you've been through it. It's like my runs in the morning. You know what? There's not that's the hardest part of my day, honestly, is getting up at 4 and going on these runs. So what else is – the rest of the day becomes easy. It's all relative. So if you go through hard work to become great – COVID happens. Okay, you've been through, you're psychologically tougher. You're more disciplined. You're more focused. You can manage it. If you're weak mentally because you've just been pretending the whole time, it's gonna crush you. You can't handle it because you're just not that person, right? So it's the intrinsic. It's like actually becoming better and becoming great. You can do it, but you have to work. Like, there's no other way. This doesn't grow on trees and it doesn't get handed to you. There's no pretending at some level. You have to actually become that person, right?
And for people to get mentally stronger, other than social media, are there anything else you recommend? Because for your job, by the way, as cool as it sounds to be CEO, there's a lot of stress of, you know, a company on your shoulders, people's salaries, people's like livelihoods, right? In some capacity, it's like,
yeah, absolutely.
There's so much stress there.
Absolutely. And my advice is it's conquest that makes you stronger. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, what makes you stronger mentally is looking at something, looking at a mountain that you didn't think you can climb and then climbing it. And then being like, I did that. And then the next time something comes that you're not sure you can do, you'll have more confidence. And confidence and competence are related, i.e. believing you can and actually doing something. Once you do things that are hard, you'll believe you can. And once you believe you can, you'll do things that are hard. Do you know what I'm saying? Those are interlinked. And so my advice is just find a challenge. I like physical challenges because you can literally say, I'm going to run 5 miles. I've never run 5 miles, but I'm going to do it. Boom, done. Right? Or I'm going to go on this hike. It looks scary, but I'm going to do it. Like, that's a very easy way to do it. It's just, or bike riding, whatever, pick something. And just say, or join a gym, join a boxing, whatever, and say, I'm going to do this. It seems hard. I'm scared of it, but I'm going to go do it. And then you conquer it. And then your mind gets used to conquering challenges. Right. So, and then from a career perspective, take things on there too. Right. You know, if you have a job and there's an opportunity to join a team that's going to have to work hard but could do something special, maybe go for it, right? So it's the boring answer, because it's just what it takes is taking on facts, challenges and working, right? But you got to build the discipline. And, you know, once you build the discipline, it becomes easy. The first time's hard. Yeah. I remember the first time I never played football until I got to Maryland, and I joined the football team, and it was like a state champion, you know, a caliber team, and they worked, right? And my freshman year, I had to go do two-a-days, and I almost died. You know, I was like, you know, a freshman, I was like, I was about to quit, you know, two-a-days, running hills, like working all day. But by the time I was a sophomore, junior, it was easy. Oh, two-a-days. Like, we've done it a few times. And it was the same workout, but it felt easier, right? Because you've gone through it, right? So the only remedy is experience. So you just have to pick yourself up, wake up one day and say, I'm going to get it done. And just do that.
1,000%. And, you know, you and I were just speaking offline about it. I've found that my self-confidence has gone up as I've kept the promises to myself. So when I told myself, hey, I'm going to lose 50 pounds, and I go out and execute on it, my self-confidence goes up because you're keeping the promises you keep to yourself.
Now, Mir, when you get a business challenge, you say, I'm going to deal with that. Now you believe yourself, right? Because your self-confidence is up. You can't lie to yourself. It's hard to lie to your mentality, like your subconscious. You know what I'm saying? You either are or you aren't. So when you go run, you've lost the weight, you're feeling good. Now the challenge comes in your business life. You say, I'm going to conquer it. This is what I'm going to do. You believe yourself, and then you'll go get it done. Whereas if you're a person that says things and never does it, you won't even believe yourself, right?
So 100%.
Any challenge will crush you.
Yeah, no, I can't wait now to get into your running. But before we get into running,
yeah,
how did you end up becoming the CEO of PF Chang's?
Yeah, so it started as an investment. Right. So I led the deal to buy P.F. Chang's on behalf of my employer, Paulson & Company.
This is after you left Goldman?
So after I left Goldman, I worked at a private equity firm called CPG Capital for 2 years. Then I went to business school. I went to Harvard. And then I worked for a hedge fund investor named John Paulson, who was one of the great investors of our time, like a very famous investor. So he has a hedge fund called Paulson & Company. So I went to go work there. And while I was there, I did a bunch of different things. But one thing I did was this deal, right? So PF Chang's was up for sale. This is like 2018. I had some friends in that were selling the company, right, that I worked with at Goldman. So they gave me the look and said, you know, PM Shakes is up for sale. And I more or less looked at it and thought it was a good investment. So I pitched it to my boss. I pitched it to John Paulson and said, you know, we should buy this. And here's why. And here's the plan. And here's the thesis. And here's the numbers. And we walked through it and John agreed. So I then executed the deal. I led the deal to buy it. So for me, it was an investment. I thought it was a good opportunity. I thought it was a good business. I thought it was a good brand with a lot of potential. A lot of things weren't being done well, but we felt like we could fix these things, right? Like the delivery business and some other things, right? So, I got involved as an investor. I joined the board when we closed the deal. Then I started. Now, the thing is, I was responsible for it, right? I convinced people at Paulson to buy it. So it's my deal. And, you know, I'm sitting in New York. And there were a lot of things we wanted to do at the company, right? We wanted to remodel all the restaurants. We wanted to build this delivery platform, build an app, build a website, PF Chang's to go. Like, there's a lot of strategic changes. We didn't buy it just to run it the way it'd been run, right? We bought it to change a lot of things. And so when you're transforming a company like that, it's hard to do from New York when you're calling people, and it's easier to get things done when you're here physically. Right. Mm-hmm. If I'm calling from New York, people can kind of BS and give you the runaround. And, you know, if I'm here, it's things get done. Right. So I just started coming every week just to push things forward. Right. So I'd fly out every Monday. I'd fly back every Thursday. And then the CEO at the time that we brought in, Antiaco, said, you know, if you're going to be here every week, you need a title. So they gave me a title. They made me chief strategy officer.
So you're working at two firms at the time.
Yeah, right? I was working at two firms. So I was still working at Paulson, but this was a big deal. John wrote a big check to buy the company. And I just wanted to make sure it was successful. So I was just out here just trying to make sure things were getting done, right? And the CEO we brought in appreciated that because he didn't necessarily want to deal with all this transformational work, right? Like, he was a nuts and bolts operator, you know, 70 plus years old. We brought him out of retirement, but he knew how to run restaurants really well. That's what he did. Now the app, the website, the remodels, he was less interested in that. It was more interested in the nuts and bolts operation. So I said, hey, let me come in. I'll be your man to get things done on the other stuff that you don't want to deal with. We actually lived together. He traveled from Dallas every week and I traveled from New York every week. And we got an apartment together. We're just running the company together for a year.
Wow.
And so then he eventually stepped during COVID. You know, like I said, he's 73 years old. Was traveling every week. So COVID happened. He wasn't going to be traveling anymore. Decided to step back. And so we didn't have a CEO. And then, you know, Paulson asked me to step in, right? He's like, you're there every week. You know what's going on. It's your deal. Go deal with it. Go fix it, right? Like, it was a crazy time because it's during COVID. All the restaurants were closed. So it wasn't even clear how the business was going to perform or if we were going to be able to get through the situation. But again, it was my deal and I felt responsible for the outcome. So I came out, stepped in as CEO while all the restaurants were closed, had to get through the most difficult time in the restaurant industry that I'm aware of. And, you know, we got through it, but not without some scars and not without some hard work, right? Like it was a crisis, like you know, so.
And, you know, a couple of key takeaways there is you sort of stayed ready. Like when this deal happened, you never, a lot of times Gen Zs, we visualize like where we want to be, but I love that you said that because you just showed us that it's not like you looked at the deal and said, hey, I'm going to be CEO here. You saw an opportunity. You were bullish on the thesis. And then when the time arrived, you didn't know COVID-19 was going to happen. None of us did, frankly. So like, but the key is once it did present itself to you, you were ready. How did you build trust with Paulson for him to say, hey, obviously this is your deal outside of just presenting it to take on CEO? Because a lot of us might be figuring out how we build trust with our managers now or investors if we're raising capital or whatever it might be. How did he know that it's like time for you to go do that?
Well, the point you made is a good one, right? Which is I didn't plan to be CEO, but sometimes the moment calls and you got to step up. And it might not be exactly what you planned, but the, you know, sometimes the moment chooses you, not the other way around, mm-hmm. right? So you got to be ready. And when the moment comes, make, you know, you get these opportunities in life and you got to take them, right? And you got to make the most of them. And each step leads to the next step, right? Like if a moment comes and you succeed, they'll create other moments, right? So it's important to recognize them and step up and get the job done when these moments do occur, right? Like when I needed to step in as CEO, I came and it was 100% of what I was doing, right? Like 100% of my focus, 100% of my time. We're going to get through this. And, you know, we did. Now, in terms of Building trust with John, I'll say that that happened over time. There's no one thing, but it was consistency, right? Mm-hmm. I first interned with John in 2016, right? And when I was at Harvard, and my first summer, I was pitching ideas, getting in front of him, being, you know, thoughtful about the book and about our investments. And so from the very beginning, you show who you are and what you're capable of and how you think. And then you remain consistent. You know, I worked for John for years where I had a bunch of different things I was covering for him, but he knew he could trust me on every one of those, right? Like, not that you're always going to be right, but you're going to be high character. You're going to be a sound thinker. You're going to be, you know, thoughtful about the business. You're going to be somebody he can trust to manage things, right? And that happens over time. So by the time this deal came across, I'd done, you know, 100 things with John, right? And, you know, he'd put me on different boards. I'd managed those well. So it's incremental. And so when this deal came across, the trust is already there. And then we just look at the, you know, we're both very objective. John's a very objective person, as am I, right? Like, so is it a good investment or not? And then it just becomes actually evaluating the opportunity. But that trust is already there, right? And he trusts my judgment as well, right? So building trust takes time, but losing it is quick, right? So you just got to stay, consistent, right? And I'll throw this in there too. One good way to remain consistent and to build trust is to master your emotions. Be in control of your emotions, because a lot of these jobs are stressful. If I'm working for John and stress freaks me out, he's gonna be questioning whether you can trust me or not, right? Because things are gonna get stressful. He knows that. So I'd shown him over time as well that I can manage stress well. That there's never been a moment where anything got to me in a way where he had to question whether he could trust me to manage things, right? I'm steady, I'm consistent, I'm objective, I'm honest, right? Like, you're gonna make mistakes, but be like, okay, I thought this, it didn't work out that way, it's working out like this. And you can look at yourself and criticize yourself and say like, okay, I didn't get that right, but here's the plan. Here's what I'd suggest as a plan going forward, right? So self-accountability is keys for people to trust you as well.
And I think that's that managing emotion thing. I didn't realize how critical that was, but to be able to manage your emotion, not just in, because things don't stay good forever and things on the contrary don't stay 100%. Bad forever.
Things are going to happen. You know, you just got to stay up. You can't take it too, like the job is serious, but you can't beat yourself. You can't take it too seriously on yourself, right? You have to stay objective. You make the best decisions you can. You do the best you can. If you are trying the best you can, then you can honestly say, okay, that didn't go well, but here's why I thought it was a good idea. And you can sit there with your boss and have that conversation, because you made the best decision you could in the moment, right? And you can say, listen, like this, here's all the information I had. Here's what I thought would happen. Here's what I missed. And here's what actually happened. And so here's where we are now. And I think there's a good plan going forward. You can have that dialogue and turn getting something wrong into a positive, right? And maybe come up with a better plan going forward. So, but if something goes wrong and you're freaking out, and you're lying and you're saying, oh, it wasn't my fault, or, you know, it was somebody else's fault. And that's when you'll destroy trust, right? It's not the mistake, it's how you react to it that mm-hmm. matters, right? It can be the same mistake, but two people react differently. One builds trust, one loses it. It's that simple, right? So, but again, you can't fake these things. You know how you build emotional control is you go through hard things for a long time, is you put yourself in situations that are hard, and then you actually become better at it. You actually become better at it. Right. You're not pretending, right? And then when something goes wrong, you can handle it, right?
And on that topic, Damola, of hard things, you know, obviously you guys are a business now that does over $1 billion or so in revenue. That's great. That's awesome. Yeah. But COVID hits, and, you know, at some point I remember seeing articles where the business was effectively struggling. And not just P.F. Chang's, by the way, everything, Cheesecake Factory, everywhere you looked, it looked like at some point I remember seeing news on CNBC and everywhere that restaurants would you believe they were saying restaurants may never come back? Like, just like people might not ever go back into restaurants. And so I'm curious for you. I just literally had the founder of the Boca Group. And if you've been in Chicago, you know all the Boca restaurants here. And, you know, that was the same fear that he had. How did you, I know you know how to manage stress very well, but what was your game plan? COVID hits, what was your action as CEO on day one to say, hey, here's the steps we're going to take. Here's how we're going to turn this thing around despite a crisis going on.
I mean, it wasn't easy. Let me just say that, right? The restaurants were all closed. And, you know, the restaurant business has a high fixed cost component. If you're not making any money and you've got rents and labor and all these other costs, like, it's not a good financial picture. So, you know, it was nerve-wracking, right? Now, you have to, number one, solve for survival in a situation like that, right? So what are the immediate things we can do to help ourselves? We got to do more delivery, right? Because that's all you can do right now. So how do we maximize our delivery sales? How do we maximize takeout? How do you make it easier for people to come order from you? How do you get the word out? How do you market? So these are like tactical things immediately to manage the situation. How do you bring your expenses down? Are there things we can pull back on? Do we need to spend on that, right? Like, you got to manage the P&L to manage your cash flow to survive, as you know, first and foremost. And then in addition to that, you want to instill some calm and confidence into the organization, right? People panicking and thinking that the world's going to end is not ideal, right? So you need to speak to the organization in a way that lays out a believable plan. So you need to come up with a plan, right? But once you have a plan, you need to communicate it, right? And say, we're going to make it, and here's how, and here's the plan, and we're going to drive incremental revenue this way. We're going to manage our expenses that way. We're going to make these certain investments. We're going to pull back here and communicate. People are smart. They want to hear what's going on, and they know the business, right? People are savvy, and they know, and then they can tell when it's panic or when there's a calm leader, like a leader that's got a plan, right? So come up with a plan, then you got to communicate it in a way that instills confidence, and then you got to execute, right? And then that's you and the team putting in the hours, right? Going through and making sure, like, okay, we like the plan, people are bought in, let's go get this done, right? Now you can really rally an organization in a moment of crisis, right? Like, it's back against the wall sort of thing, right? Think about, you know, I always use sports analogies, but fourth quarter, games on the line, people are going to be focused, right? And so you can rally the organization in a moment of crisis, get everybody on the same page, and then go get it done, right?
I remember, you know, when I was seeing the changes you guys were making at PF Chang's, was there one specific thing that you looked at and said, hey, this really helped transform us to get us to the strong position right today? Was it the delivery decision, or was it just a combination of things?
You know, we prioritized delivery from the moment we bought the business. Okay. In 2018. We thought that was a huge opportunity. I mean, it's Asian food, it's Chinese food, right? It's not you're not teaching anybody any new behaviors. That's a normal American consumer behavior, is to order Chinese, right? And order delivery and order a takeout. The company just didn't do it well. There was no app, there was no website, the infrastructure wasn't there. So we saw an opportunity. If you could build a system to make it easy for people and market it effectively, you could build a huge business on the delivery side. That was part of the thesis when I pitched it to John in 2018. Now, so we got working on that in 2019, as soon as we bought the company. So the timing is a bit lucky, but we did have the foresight to focus on delivery even before COVID, just because we thought it was an important business that was going to grow. I mean, I lived in New York. I was a consumer of Uber Eats and DoorDash, right? Like, I was ordering delivery all the time. And I knew that was a growing customer behavior. And there were some companies that had figured it out, like Domino's and Chipotle, et cetera, had figured out delivery and built great businesses. This company just hadn't done it, but the food was perfect for it. And the brand was strong, and you could. So we saw an opportunity where other people might have missed it, right? The previous owners obviously weren't focused on it. So by the time COVID hit, we'd built that platform, and that saved the company, right? Because it's hard to, you know, they shut restaurants down end of March. It's hard to say in April, we're going to start doing delivery. If you don't have an app, you don't have a website, you don't have any of the things you need, right? So we'd already done all of that. So we could make the transition. And then I'll say the other important thing is we stayed focused on the long-term strategy, even in the middle of the chaos, right? So we solved kind of the near-term things we needed to do to survive. But at the same time, we kept the five-year plan in mind, right? Like, what are the things we want to achieve in the long-term? What investments do we still want to make? And John Paulson was incredibly supportive, right? Like, it wouldn't have been possible without him. But he gave us what we needed to keep making investments, to keep remodeling restaurants, to keep building a company that was going to be great for the long-term. Right. And that proved to be key.
I love that. And it definitely proved to be key. It's congratulations on all the success you guys have had. Now, I'm curious, when you think of thesis and setting a strategy for 3, 5, 10 years, how flexible are you in your thesis itself? Like, at what point do you go, well, I thought this is the answer, but the market's telling us this.
It's a balance. You don't want to be intransigent, but you don't want to be changing your strategy every quarter either. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, a strategy, you got to remember, also is very high level. There's differences between strategy and tactics. You shouldn't be changing your strategy very much, right? Our strategy is 5 bullet points that I showed up with in 2019 when I took over, or 2020, and it hasn't changed, the bullet points. But these are the high-level things they're trying to achieve. Like, that's still the same. That shouldn't be changing quarter to quarter, year to year. Your tactics might change, right? So how are we going to – what are the specific things we're working on to drive these strategies, right? So we – OPD is one strategy of ours. Now, you might say, you know, we were going to do, you know, delivery ourselves. Now we're going to do more with the third parties. Those are tactics, right? And that stuff can change. You got to be flexible and look at the data and understand what's working and what's not. But if you have a sound strategy, it shouldn't change very much. And if it does, it should be a good reason. You should communicate it well. Make sure everybody's clear that that's what's happening, right? But you can't, you got to have a North Star as a company. You got to know who you are. You got to know what you're trying to achieve. And that's what the strategy is. And then around that, play around with tactics, try different things, test things, figure out what works, what's the best way to achieve our strategy, right?
Yeah, and talking about strategy, one thing I love to talk with CEOs about is culture. I know you're a big sports fan like myself, and I look at the culture of a team like the Miami Heat and how they, like, it doesn't matter who's playing however minutes, they just want to win. Absolutely. They don't care about that. And even, you know, us, I went to Loyola Chicago, and I was the head manager for the basketball team at the time when we went to the Final Four, and the big thing for us was the culture thing piece again.
That's like awesome.
Our coach Moser was big on culture. So for you, I'm super curious how you think about culture at PF Chang's, and what is the culture?
You know, I'd say that for me, I'm number one, I want transparency with them. I trust people. I trust that people are smart and I trust that people are aware. I don't think it behooves you to lie to an organization. A lot of people come and they obfuscate things, they hide things, and they try to give a certain message. I'd say the number one thing we've done well is be transparent, trust people with information, communicate well. Answer questions. Like, I'll sit in a town hall every quarter with the company and discuss what's going on in pretty good detail. So I think there's a culture of transparency at the organization now, which is good, right? Because people know what's going on, and they feel empowered, right, with information. The other thing I'll say is there's a culture of everybody here works well together and is trying to solve the same things and all benefit from the same. From the same things. There's like a togetherness, right? You'll have organizations where each department kind of works on its own, right? And they don't talk much, and but that's not my style. And I think, again, because I have a team background, right? Like, so I'm in my COO's office, I'm in my CMO's office. I expect them to be in each other's office. They talk to this person, talk to that person. So there's a collaborative culture, but then also we set it so that everybody does well when the company does well, right? So the better the company does, the more we can invest in our people, right? So we've done all types of things from, we introduced PTO, paid time off for the hourly employees, which they didn't have before. Benefits,
wow.
Bonuses, right? Tied to company performance. So everybody knows that if the business does well, they'll do well. You're in it together. And there's, you know, I only have one metric. I track EBITDA, which is bottom line profitability, and everybody gets paid on that from a bonus perspective.
Wow.
Because there were a bunch of different metrics for different groups and all these different things, and then everybody's swimming different directions. So one thing I like to do is one metric that encompasses everything, bottom line profitability, and everybody is compensated on that, right? So everybody's watching the same thing and everybody cares about the same thing. And they know if they're helping another department, it helps them too, right? Like, there's this, we're all in it together mentality. So I think clarity of communication and transparency is key. And then finding a way to bring an organization together so you're swimming the same direction. Everybody knows what the plan is. Everybody knows what the strategy is. Everybody does well if the company does well, and you'll have the elements for a successful culture within the organization.
Yeah, and Damola, I think even before speaking to you, just following you over the last couple of years, even on LinkedIn, your transparency is something key. Like, you're transparent about your schedule, about what you're doing, about the business. So this inclusivity of saying, hey, whether I'm an hourly worker, whether I'm a manager, or whether I'm the CMO, we're all getting paid by that bottom line EBITDA, which is what matters the most. That's important to those employees.
Yeah. They understand what they're solving for. Do you know what I mean? And that people are smart. If you give people a benchmark and a high bar, but they'll be taken care of if they achieve it, people are going to work harder than if they don't know what they're chasing. They don't know what the metric is. If they do, even if they get it, they're not going to get anything from it personally. Then people aren't going to care. Yeah. It's how do you get people to care, basically, right? And so it's important. You can't do this by yourself. This is not business is not a one man show, right? Like, you need people to care, and you need to be generous with people who do well for you, right? Like, people need to, like, I want people to make money. It makes me happy. If because they get paid on the performance of the company. So if they're making money, the company's doing well. Everybody's good.
Yeah.
You know? So it's, you can't, it seems like it's common sense, but you'll find a lot of people are greedy or they're opaque. They don't want to communicate. They don't trust the employees. And I think that's a mistake. Hire great people, first of all, right? That's number one. Get great people in your organization. So recruiting is key. And then once you get them there, give them information, trust them, empower them, align them to the business and let them run, right? And you'll see they'll do incredible things, right? Because they want to, they understand what they're trying to do, and they get you know, a benefit from it as well, right?
Yeah, and on that concept of recruiting, the CEO title is amazing, but there's also tough parts that come with the job. You know, the hiring is one thing, and there's also the unfortunate reality of firing too. I speak to a lot of CEOs about that. You know, how do you think, when you think about hiring and firing, what can you share with the audience about like how a CEO from that management perspective looks at hiring someone versus firing someone?
Hiring is the most important thing you can do as an organization, like bar none. Getting the right people in here, number one. So you want to build good processes. We had good processes when I took over, so it's not something we had to start over with. We refined it, we tweaked it, but you want to have a clear idea about the type of person that does well in your organization, because every company is a little different, cultures are a little different. So what are you looking for, right? And then go find those people and recruit them, pay them fairly, take care of them, right? Like, firing is hard. It's the hardest part of the job, right? Firing people is the hardest part of the job. It's unpleasant always, right? There's not a, even if it's been a long time coming, or if it's the right decision, it's still going to be a difficult conversation. Part of being a leader is having the tough conversations. The best thing you can do is be honest, treat people with respect, and say, you know, give them the reason, right? And handle it like that. If it's handled well, it can be benefit for everybody, because they can hopefully find an organization that fits them better. And you can find a person that fits your organization better, but it's still a difficult conversation that needs to be handled delicately, because you're dealing with people's lives and you can't be callous about it, right? So there's a decision and there's how you deal with it, which you got to get both right. Now, if you need to fire somebody, you need to fire somebody. Like, there's, you know, you can't not do it because you're scared of having a conversation. But when you have that convo, make it, you know, just be thoughtful about it and, you know, try to be kind, right? Like, it's a hard thing, you know, and give them honest feedback so they can be better in the future, right? And that's the best thing you can do.
And that's great advice, because we tend to have this negative connotation with it, but sometimes you're actually doing the person the benefit to end up in a better organization for them.
100%. If they accept it well, they can be better. So, okay, they got fired. Why? If people get fired, it happens, right? Okay, why? What did I do? What can I be better at? Like, they can take it and internalize it and hopefully improve. And also, maybe it's just not a fit. And then they can find a better fit, right? Based on, you kind of having that conversation with them. So there can be positives. It's never going to be an easy or fun conversation, but it can work out well for both sides if handled well on both sides, right?
Right. And on that point, I can just sense you're the type of person that doesn't take stuff personal. Unfortunately, my generation, we take a lot of things personal. And Damola, I'll be honest with you, I take things personal sometimes too, right?
Sure.
What's your advice for people to get better at taking things personally? Because a lot of times it's not personal, it's business or it's relationship, whatever it is.
You're going to take things personal, 100%, right? Like, that's human, that's natural. So there's two things. First of all, with failures and setbacks and like misses, right? Like, you went for something, you missed it. My advice in those situations is, you're allowed to feel bad for 24 hours and then get over it, right? So you missed something, you got something, you didn't get something you wanted. You're gonna feel bad for a minute. Give yourself a day, right? But then after that, the only thing you should be thinking about is what can I do better? Like, why didn't I get it? Did I give it everything I had? Was there some mistake? Is there something I should improve? Just use that to be better. And if you do that, you'll improve over time, because you learn more probably from the things you don't get than the things you do get. Right? You failing can be the best motivator to improve. It doesn't mean you're not going to feel bad. I get it, right? Like, everybody's human. So you don't get something you really wanted, you're going to feel bad. Give yourself a day and then be back in there. Like, what can I do better? Now, in terms of like taking things personally, like feedback and things like that, critiques, it's similar, right? Try to remove yourself, almost like you want to disassociate yourself from yourself, right? Like, look at yourself objectively. It's hard, I know, but listen, nobody's perfect. Nobody's perfect. Yes. Nobody's perfect. Yes. And so you sit there and you say, okay, this is what they're saying. This is what the feedback is. I'm not going to get mad about it. I'm going to try to assess whether there's something in it or not, right? Most of the time there is. People aren't just saying things to make you feel bad, right? So most of the time there's some validity to it, and you got to figure out what you believe and what you don't, right? But you can only do that if you're objective, right? And say, okay, you know, they said, it's almost like you want to look at yourself from the third person and say, is that true? Is there some truth to that? Because then you can also improve based on those sort of things, right? So it's emotional mastery. It's emotional control. It's the most important thing you can learn, right? Because nobody's dying. This is nothing's that serious. You're trying to be the best person you can be. You're trying to make a mark in the world. You're trying to achieve. So the best way to do that is to not take things personally and be objective about things. If this was 1,000 years ago, people die if they made a mistake, right? Yeah. That's not the case anymore. You're pretty safe, right? So just be better and try to take everything as an opportunity to improve, and your life will be better as a result.
Gosh, I got to say, Damola, out of all the interviews you have done, this has been the most emotional type masterclass, like learning how to master those emotions. That is such a gem. I took away so much. Like, I just can't wait for the audience to see this because, wow, emotions run everything. Emotions run markets, right? You buy a stock that you like, a year later, it's down 60%. And now you're saying, was it a good investment? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the best investors are the ones that control their emotions too, right? You talked to Buffett. I got to meet Buffett.
Nice.
And I mean, it couldn't be more objective, right? Like, he's not John Paulson, my boss, right? Like, couldn't be more objective, right? Everybody's going to have emotions. I'm not saying become a machine or a robot. You're going to have emotions, but you need to understand what you're feeling. And as long as your emotions don't dictate your actions directly, you're okay.
Yeah.
Right. You'll feel what you feel, but create a gap where you can say, okay, I felt this. I understand that. But what do I actually need to do?
Right.
Right. And then act based on logic.
Yeah.
Feel and then, you know, internalize it. That's fine. Feelings kind of give you information. Right. Like, you feel bad and you don't want to feel bad anymore. Okay, like, how can I actually get better? But if you feel bad and you quit, or if you feel bad and you freak out or you start yelling at people, then the action is not a constructive one, right?
Yeah, I love that. That's a masterclass right there on emotion. Now, as we transition into the conclusion here,
good.
I know that, you know, speaking of schedules, because you're on a schedule, we appreciate your time here over the last hour. You went viral, specifically, I saw it over the last month, for your 4 a.m. runs. Number one, I want to ask you about your 4 a.m. runs and what time you go to bed. But two, can you, after answering that, can you also just talk about your schedule? Like, what does your actual full day look like?
Yeah. So the reason I do it is because I started building up my runs and they're just long now. Like, I'll run for like an hour, 20 minutes when I do like an 8 miler. Wow. And it varies day to day. Some days I'll do sprints, some days I'll do different things, but my long runs will be like an hour, 20 minutes. So I need the time. And then I'm getting old, man. I got to stretch before, I got to stretch after, you know, back before when I was young, I'd just get out there and run, but you know, can't quite do that anymore.
So you're very young, man.
Yeah. So I like the time and I don't like to be rushed. And so that's why I started getting up earlier and earlier until I hit this 4 a.m. But it's good. It's beautiful, man. I'm out there. The sun's rising.
Every day you wake up at 4?
Yeah. Every day I'm up at 4 and I do my stretches. I'm out on the road by 4:30, or I'm doing sprints or something else. During the week, I mean, weekends, I give myself more time. And it's amazing because you're the only one. I'm the only one out there, right? And by the time the sun's coming up, people start moving around. I'm already like an hour into a workout, right? So I like it, you know. But I'll say this. I played sports my whole life, so I'm used to having to get up early for something or the other, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when I played football at Brown, you're up at 5 to do workouts. Like, that was – so I've already kind of developed the ability to do that. But if you struggle, my advice to you is this, right? Put your phone not next to your bed. Put it somewhere else in your room. You have to get up to go turn it off. Set the alarm, and when it goes off, just go make yourself a cup of coffee. That's all you got to do. The reason people can't get up is because it seems like an insurmountable task. Like, oh, I got to go run 5 miles. No, just go get a cup of coffee. And then by the time you get the cup of coffee, you'll be awake. Then you go do the thing you said you were going to do, right? You break it into steps, right? David Goggins says this, but can you take one more step, right? Like, when you feel like you can't do something. So set the alarm, go turn it off, go just get yourself a cup of coffee, and then just take the one more step, right? And you'll be, before you know, you'll be out there. It's not hard. Anybody can do it. It's not hard, right? Like, you don't have to, you'll build up the how much you run and blah, blah, blah. You'll figure out what works for you, but it's just getting up. That's the thing. If you get up and you start the day, it doesn't have to be 4, and then I've built this up, but set your alarm for 5, right? Do it tomorrow. Set it for 5. Put the phone on a table, not next to your bed. So you got to physically get up, When it goes off, make coffee and tell me if you can't go get a workout in. I bet you can.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm gonna try that actually tonight to see if I can get up a little bit earlier. Not four. I can't get to four yet, man. That's a different level.
Pick a time. Just set a schedule. It's not about the time. I start my day early because I try to do a lot in the morning. And right. You know, but whatever it is, just set the time and stick to it. It's more about telling yourself the truth, like we talked about, like starting to believe in yourself, right? And having discipline and knowing that if you say you're gonna do something, you're actually gonna do it. That's right. What matters. The details. Right. Play around with the details. The time, the workout, whatever. Just get into some routine. Right. It'll be a benefit for you.
I love that. And so you're out on the field. You're running by 4:30. What does the rest of your day look like schedule wise?
So you know, depending on what I do from a workout, I'm done maybe by 6, right? And I'm trying to be in the office between 7 and 7:30. Okay. And maybe I'll work from my home office for a bit and come in at 8. Some variation on that. And then my day is just, it's usually just full of meetings, right? So meetings with the internal team, meetings with my department heads, meetings with investors, debt holders, partners, international partners. And then so every day is different, but there'll be some sequence of meetings that I have during the day. And then in my gaps, I just try to keep things moving, right? So I'll get a bunch of emails during the day and try to prioritize and, you know, if there's something I can answer quickly, if you have a bunch of things to do, some things are quick, some things are going to take a long time. Some things are really important. Some things are less important. The quick, important, do those fast. Yeah. Right. If you can get something and answer in 5 minutes and it's important, that's the stuff you want to do first. And then depending how much time I have, you try to prioritize the important things that are going to take longer. Right. If you get like an hour window, you work on something. Right. So it's basically meetings and in between, I'm just trying to keep the ball moving in different parts of the company, right? Because a lot of things come to me for approval or for opinion before a decision can get made. And so you just don't want to be the holdup, do you? Right? Like if people are ready to go, then I try to get to that stuff quickly.
And how do you find time for like your social life too?
Well, you know, it's something's got to give. Like I'm not out during the week or anything like that, you know, because it's hard to do everything. Right. Mm-hmm. I've got a great group of friends. They know me. They know I'm out here trying to do things. So, you know, I'm not like out on a Wednesday night or Tuesday night or anything like that. But I've got great friends. I catch up with them usually on the weekends. And it's a balance. But you can't do everything. You can do anything in life. But you can't like try to do this huge professional achievement at the same time. Go out every night at the same time, you know, travel all the time. Like you got to prioritize. Right. And yeah. You know, people tell you can do everything. That's not true. You can do anything, but you it's hard to do everything, right? You got to pick what you care about.
Yeah, and I get the sense that discipline and running just relates through the rest of your day the same way.
100%. Can you take one more step? That's it. Because when hard things come, just break it down, right? And that's what you do in the morning when you start this routine, is you can take that one more step, and then it becomes easy, right? Because there's nothing you can't do that's on your list. It's just things you don't feel like or you don't want to. But once you get to the mentality of like, I know I don't feel like it, but can I just do one little thing? Then it becomes a lot easier.
Is there anything that keeps you up at night, or for you, you sleep just fine? You know, you're very chilled in general.
I'm pretty chill, but I'd say that the macros, the stuff that you can't control is the most concerning, right? Like when you run a business that's a consumer discretionary business and the macro picture is difficult, that concerns you, right? Like, and you can't control it. You just got to watch the numbers and kind of see what's going on. So as organizationally, I try to control what we can control and just be as aware as we can of the things we can't control. But of course, you know, you're going to be, you know, what's the Fed going to do? What's going to happen here? What's the consumer picture going to look like? You know, that stuff is out there. But overall, you know, sleep fine. I got to get up early.
Yeah, you got to. Yeah. And I know we're running out of time here, Damola. Thanks for going past. The hot take for you real quick that I posted on social media about us doing the interview. One thing I thought everyone was going to ask, how did he build the business? How do we do this? But one question that came up said, I'm super curious. If he walked into PF Chang's, what is Damola ordering? Like, what's your go-to order?
Let's go. I usually get the sea bass.
Okay.
Which is top notch. If you're in PF Chang's, try the sea bass. Also the Wagyu steak, which we came out with last holidays, is absolutely fire. So those are my two go-tos. Yeah. You can't go wrong with either one.
And I feel like with those, you know, even for me with my weight loss journey, I can balance it out where it's not too many carbs.
Absolutely.
You can eat healthy.
You can make the sea bass work, get a nice Caesar salad or Asian Mandarin salad. you can make it work with our menu for sure.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that's, so last question for you. I ask every guest this. Everyone, a lot of college kids just graduated. It's June now. Everyone's graduating.
Yeah.
What's Damola's, 30 to 60 second commencement speech to the college grads today? Obviously, you just gave us an hour commencement speech with the gems you dropped, but what's your minute speech there?
Well, kids today face unique challenges, right? You mentioned social media. That's huge, and it's true. And it's much harder than when I was their age. My advice to young people is to find a way to create more isolation for themselves so they can really think and understand themselves. Because it's hard to do when there's all the noise of social media and all your friends are doing this and that and this and that. Like, you don't even know who you are at some point because you get lost in all the noise. So find a way to create mental space to think for yourself and not be trying to live up to anything. Or like, what do you want out of life? What are you trying to achieve? What do you care about? Who are you, right? And it's not because that guy posted this on Instagram, you think you need to go do X, Y, and Z. You need some isolation. You need some time to think, right? And you've got to find a way to create that. I say delete social media. I know most people won't do that, but if, even if you keep it, just understand it for what it is and create isolated time to think.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I love that. That is Damola Adamalukhin, who is the current CEO of PF Chang's, also a partner at a famous fund here. And we just had him be our mentor today. It's been an absolute honor and pleasure. And thank you for giving us a masterclass. And I'm going to go try a run tomorrow. So I'm holding.
Good.
I got to do that.
That's Get out there, man. I love it.
Got to do that. Guys, if you're listening in, go check out PF Chang's. Go have a bite there. It's an amazing, incredible culture, whether you're sitting there or to the point that we just learned here, even delivering it. They do a very good job with delivery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Mir. I enjoyed that.
Thank you, Damola. Thank you.